that to me. And then I remember another thing, which the man Roger Hilsman wrote me a letter about just this winter. But how one of the worst days of it all, the last day, sending some U-2 plane got loose over Alaska or something.
Mm-hmm. Violated Soviet airspace.
Yeah, but some awful thing. Oh, my God. You know, then the Russians might have thought we were sending it in. Mm-hmm. And that could have just been awful. I remember him telling me about that. And then I remember when the blockade... and then I remember hearing how Anderson at the Pentagon was mad at McNamara, wouldn't let... I don't know if that was afterwards or before, but all that thing. And then I remember just waiting with that blockade. The only thing I can think of what it was like an election night waiting, but much worse.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one ship was coming and some big fat freighter had turned back, but it didn't have anything but oil on it anyway, and all these ships cruising forward. And I remember hearing that the Joseph P. Kennedy was there and saying to Jack, did you send it or something? And he said, no, isn't that strange? Or, you know, and just remembering, and then finally some ship turned back or was boarded or something, and then that was when you heaved the first relief, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember, you know, the day finally when it was over and saying to me, and Bundy saying to me either then or later, you know, that if it had just gone on maybe two more days, everybody really would have cracked. Because
mm-hmm.
all of those men had been awake night and day. Taz Shepard in the Situation Room or something. I remember I had something to ask him once, and they said, you can't, he's been day and night. You know, everyone. And just thought, and then I wrote a letter to McNamara afterwards, which I showed to Jack. But I remember everyone had worked to the peak of human endurance.
Mm-hmm. President show fatigue?
Well, as the days went on, yes, but, you know, he always, you didn't worry about him in fatigue because you'd seen him driving himself so much all his life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, through some awful campaign in the day that you're bone tired getting up at 5 to be at a factory gate and still make. So you knew he always would have some hidden reserve to draw on. But, you know, oh boy, towards the end, I always think that if you're told how much longer you have to go on, you can always make it.
Mm-hmm.
But the awful thing then was you didn't know. And finally, when it was over, and then I don't know how many days or weeks later it was, but he thought of giving that calendar to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked it out so carefully himself.
What about that?
And then it was a surprise. I didn't know. I was so surprised when I got one. Because he told me he wanted to do it. So he said, you know, ask Tish or Tiffany or something. So I told her, and then when they came, I was so surprised that I had one.
Mm-hmm.
And I burst out crying.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about Stevenson and the UN side of it?
Well, I don't remember any of that at the time. I just remember when the article by Charlie Bartlett or something came out later.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then I remember, and I don't know how much later that was.
Was it about 6 weeks later, was it? Early December. Charlie Bartlett and Stewart also.
So then I remember the discussion then. I don't think Jack ever said anything at the time or... didn't Lyndon just come to one of those meetings and then to none of the others? I think he came either to the one at the end or the one at the beginning. If he came at the one at the beginning, he didn't want to get involved with everything that was going on, or else what I think is more like it, he came at the one at the end and didn't want to give any opinion.
Mm-hmm.
As usual, he just didn't want to get put on position anywhere.
Yeah.
And he could have come to all those meetings too, and he didn't come to one. I don't know what he was doing. Remember, and there was something with Chester Bowles too.
That was the earlier Cuba.
That's right.
Chester was in India.
And Bobby said, I remember the first one Bobby said to him.
No, Chester wasn't in India, but he wasn't involved
in
this. No, this was the first Cuba that he was involved in.
That's right. And where he was going to say that he didn't disagree, that he didn't agree,
mm-hmm.
and Bobby said everyone who leaves this room agrees or something.
Mm-hmm.
But
Did the president have any particular reactions to the Charlie's piece?
Oh, yes. You know, that was awful, wasn't it? It was awful with Adelaide and this and that. And I think with Charlie's... It's all so involved now. But I think, wasn't Charlie's piece right?
Not really, no. I mean, everybody had taken a whole series of positions on this, and various people at various times had taken various positions, and various things have been suggested. As you mentioned, the case of Mac, who was both, you know, one time he was a hawk and another time he was a dove, and the thing was, there was two viewpoints existed, but I think at one time or another, nearly everyone around that table had took one or another of the viewpoints. It much oversimplified the...
Well, anyway, I mean, Jack was just upset over the flap of the article. And then I remember, is it later that winter or in February, when I went to New York and went to the UN with Adelaide, and Clayton had told me that it would be so nice if we would ask Adelaide to some of our private parties, that that could really make things up. I thought, well, anyway, that really made an awful difference to Adelaide when I went to lunch at the UN and I gave him a little watercolor that I'd done. I'd done it, Jack and I were just sitting there one night, of a sphinx I had, and I just had it in my briefcase, and he framed it and everything, and then we did come down to a party. I mean, you had to do things to sort of soothe his feelings, cause
mm-hmm.
but that did smooth over very nicely,
mm-hmm.
finally. But you know what I was just thinking about, the Cuban crisis? The difference between Jack and Lyndon Johnson, and where it's really going to make a difference in this country, is now there's a terrible crisis going on in Laos, but nobody really knows it except in the papers. And where's Lyndon? And so these people go out to Hawaii, and before they go, Lyndon hasn't met with him for 3 days. And where is he now? He's running all around Texas getting high school and college degrees. And the poor man's terrified in a way. Dave Powers says he can't bear to go to Camp David or any place he's alone, that now he has beach chairs around the pool, and on weekends he likes to sit in the pool and they have drinks there and all his cronies. But he can't bear ever to be alone and face something awful or discuss with these people. Maybe he wants to disassociate himself, so if it goes wrong he can say, I wasn't there, or it's McNamara's war. Partly I think he's panic-struck and doesn't know what to do. And that man came in, there wasn't a problem for 7 months, which Jack had made possible. And I guess it's very good for the country that he could go around and make this air of good feeling and lull so many people into this sense of security, which they wanted after all the tragedy of November. But, you know, a president has to be, I mean, that's where the terrible things are going to happen, because every little group is off, you know, having their own different meetings on Laos, and they're not thinking on Vietnam, and they're not thinking of, I mean, Jack always said the political thing there was more important than the military, and nobody's thinking of that, and they don't call the people who were in it before in. And so that's the way chaos starts. If you read the story of the Bay of Pigs in the papers now, remember the CIA just operating so in the dark, saying even if you get an order from the president, go ahead with it. Well, that's the kind of thing that's going to happen again. And, I've seen it from the people I talk to in Washington now, sort of piecing things here and there together. And how Joe Kraft told me Lyndon came to somebody's house in Georgetown the other night, and they made an oral history of it. Got very drunk, stayed till 3 or 4, and said, I just don't know if I'm capable to be president, if my equipment is adequate. It was just, Well, and I also saw, this is off the track talking about Lyndon, and people will think I'm bitter, but I'm not so bitter now. But I just wanted to be put in context the kind of president Jack was and the kind Lyndon is. Stupid old Harold Stassen said last weekend, and if only someone else had said it, because it's rather true thought, that Johnson would be like Harding, and it would be another era of good feeling. And business liked Harding, and the senators liked Harding. And he didn't keep too much sort of tabs on the people who worked under him, so they could sort of be a bit corrupt here and there, which again... And then look what happened. You know, and that's what I just hope. You know, that's going to happen. Lyndon can ride on some of the great things Jack did, and a lot of them will go forward because they can't be stopped. Civil rights, the tax bill, the gold rain stop. And maybe he'll do something more about the alliance and everything, but when something really crisis happens, that's when they're going to miss Jack. And I just want them to know it's because they don't have that kind of president and not because it was inevitable.
What sort of a vice president was Lyndon?
It was so funny because Jack, thinking of being vice president and how awful it would be, gave Lyndon so many things to do. But he never did them. I mean, he could have made his Council on Human Rights or whatever it was into something, you know, going ahead with it, equal opportunity, whatever it was. He could have done more with the space thing. He just never wanted to make any decision or do anything that would put him in any position. So what he really liked to do was go on these trips. And he never liked, Jack would say, you could never get an opinion out of Lyndon at any cabinet or national security meeting. He'd just say, you know, that he agreed with them, with everyone, or just keep really quiet. So what he'd do, he'd send him into Pakistan or something, well, then he'd be really interested in the camel drive when he came back, or then he'd ask to go to Finland or something, and that would be fine, and he'd bring back a lot of little glass birds with Lyndon written all that he'd give out. And he asked to go to Luxembourg. I mean, I think it's so pathetic when all you can find to do with a president who's dying to give you a lot to do is take a state trip to Luxembourg and Belgium, and I know in Greece they told us after his visit there that you just wouldn't believe the confusion and the frenzy and what was demanded of people and how the mess, there had to be masseurs and the pandemonium, and it was so much more than any presidential visit those people had ever seen. That's what he loved. Oh, and Lyndon had tried so hard in the beginning, Godfrey McHugh had tried in the beginning to make Jack order 4 new Air Force Ones, 707s, because we needed the one that could be the fastest. Moscow's was faster. And Jack wasn't going to spend that much money for 4 new planes. And Lyndon kept pushing him to do that. You know, Lyndon wanted a big... And then when Jack did get Air Force One, I think... I don't know if Lyndon had an Air Force One just like it or one of the older planes, but he always kept pushing for a bigger plane. And, or for more... All the kind of things like that he wanted, the panoply that goes with power, but, you know, the responsibility. And then every time he'd come home from one of these little trips, Jack would say to find out very nicely, would he like to come and report to me? Once we were in Florida in the middle of his rest and vacation, and if Lyndon were to come to report, it would have to be in the middle of the night. Which wasn't great for Jack. And he thought it would be awful for Lyndon, that Lyndon would... You know, but he'd say, find out if he'd like to or not, and if Lyndon would always like to. So he'd always be flown down with a special jet, and the press would all be alerted. And he'd come over, and of course there'd be absolutely nothing to talk about, but it would look as if, you know. So that's the kind of vice president he was, though Jack always said he was never disloyal or spoke anywhere. Well, I mean... That's only smart, but it's true.
What about political advice or dealing with Congress or so on? Did he seem to figure there?
No, Jack used to say, you know, then I don't think he'd do that, you see. Then once he wasn't majority leader anymore, he'd either think, either Jack thought this or Lyndon thought this, but he wouldn't do anything with Congress. And I don't think they'd have paid much attention to him. I mean, then they didn't like the vice, the executive stepping in. And Jack used to say more time, just to me, or as I tell you to Ben Bradley, my God, Mansfield gets more accomplished. And it was really Larry O'Brien and Mansfield. But, and I think I might have said this on an earlier tape, but one of our last dinners at the White House, maybe 2 or 3 weeks before Dallas, Ben Bradley was there. And Jack kept saying to him, now, why don't you put Mansfield on the cover of Newsweek? Why doesn't someone write something nice about him? Did I say that?
No.
And he said, he's done more. And he said, the thing is, Lyndon snowed everyone so much. He wasn't cutting up Lyndon. Because he never cut Lyndon up. Really, he was saying he snowed everyone so with his personality, but he said after all, look, it was under Eisenhower. And after all, what was done? Then he named very negligible things. And he said the situation's so much worse now, more difficult, and all these things, and he named, and it was 68% of our program the first year, 71 or 73 the second, and he said we're going to get this and this and that by, and then Ben was needling him saying, but you're not going to get the tax bill by and the civil rights bill by this year, as you said, anyway, the tax bill, as you said. And he said, God, you know, what does it matter, Ben? We're going to get the tax bill. It's going to come by in February. Okay, it's not this year, but it's 2 months later. And, you know, and this civil rights, he predicted exactly everything that would happen as the date. And Mansfield, he just thought was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And that nobody recognized it because the man played quietly.
Mm-hmm.
So, Lyndon, as vice president, didn't just do anything. But it was all right. It was fine.
Stories have been printed to the effect that there was some consideration of dropping Johnson in 64.
Not in 64. But Bobby told me this later. And I know Jack said it to me sometimes. He said, oh God, can you ever imagine what would happen to the country if Lyndon was president? So many times he'd say it, or if there was ever a problem. And then stories would come out about 64, but I don't see how you could drop him in 64.
Very hard.
But in 68, I know he was thinking, you know, in some little way, what could you do? Well, first place, I thought Lyndon would be too old then to run for president, but I said, you know, and he said, well, maybe. I mean, he didn't like that idea that Lyndon would go on and be president because he was worried for the country.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby told me that he'd had some discussions with him. I forget exactly how they were planning or who they had in mind. It wasn't Bobby. But, you know, somebody do something to name someone else in 68.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything in particular about the congressional campaign in 62? Of course, it was so dominated by the, overshadowed by the Cuban crisis. You didn't go out, I think.
No. And he didn't, you know, ask me to go out. I don't know.
At the beginning, he planned a rather short campaign and then made a longer one. On the question, would he ever talk about the legislative breakfast?
Oh, yes, because sometimes I used to be upstairs and, you know, the children would wander in. And sometimes I'd wander out of my room in my dressing gown and all those men would come out in clouds of smoke. And,
the breakfast was on the second floor, wasn't
it? Sometimes they'd be, and then later on they were in the family dining room.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, all the antique chairs that Harry DuPont had broke one by one. But he would talk about them and what was said and, you know, if it was a good one, but,
whom did he like, particularly in it? Hubert, what do you feel
about?
Yeah,
well, he loved Mansfield, and you know, Dirksen was always very nice with
mm-hmm.
him. And I guess he got, I don't know, I guess he was, well, he was very sad when Sam Rayburn died, and McCormick he'd always had trouble with, but I guess McCormick was always all right at them. I don't know, I don't, really wouldn't be fair for me to say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
One of the great mysteries around the White House was
I know one thing about the legislative breakfast that Larry O'Brien told me. This is something interesting about Ted Sorensen. Larry couldn't stand Ted Sorensen. So one night he was telling me, well, you know, they were obviously, the Irishman would be jealous of the Sorensens. But he said so many times Larry would have prepared an agenda for the breakfast. And just before they were about to start, Ted would ask to see it and take it. And he'd just change one or two sentences and then initial it TCS and pass it all around that way. And you'll see that heavy hand of Ted Sorensen in more places. I mean, he, you know, wanted his imprint on so many things.
Just self-assertion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I told you about the profiles and courage thing and learning he's doing it to Larry O'Brien, everyone. But that's just so sneaky.
He was on the whole better in the White House, though, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. But I mean, I just think...
Well, that's such a petty thing to do.
Someone said he loved himself, and finally he loved one other person, which was Jack. And he also had such a crush on Jack. I can remember when he first started to try to speak like him or dare to call him Jack. Mm-hmm. And he'd sort of blush. And I think he wanted to be easy all the ways Jack was easy. The sort of civilized side of Jack would be easy at dinners or girls like you and men. Because he knew he wasn't quite that way in the beginning, it almost went into a sort of a resentment. I mean, it was very mixed up in his own inferiority. He had a big inferiority complex. So you can see the things sort of all working back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I never saw him very much in the White House.
He was very rarely invited.
Never.
Never.
I mean, you know, I guess he came to a state dinner or so, but never a private one.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe he came to one or two of the dances, I think. But, you know, that wouldn't have been my... I mean, as he and Ted had the problems all day, that would be the last person you would invite at night.
Mm-hmm. One thing that mystified people over in the West Wing was the way George Smathers survived.
Mm.
The president would get very mad about Smathers, about Medicare, foreign aid, and say this will be the final test. And then Smathers would vote against it, and then there he'd be again.
And I used to get so mad at that and hurt. But then he'd say, he just had such charity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he really, his friendship with Smathers was before the Senate, really, and before he was married. I mean, in the Senate and before he was married. I guess they'd see each other a bit often in the summer, or, you know, Stockdale was a friend of Smathers. They weren't seeing each other so much lately. And it was really a friend of one side of Jack, or rather, I always thought, sort of a crude side. I mean, not that Jack had the crude side, but that you could laugh or hear us. You know, the kind of story sort of Smathers. I don't know, but he didn't want to stick it to someone who'd once been a friend. And he knew, and Smathers was hurting him, and he knew Smathers.
Kenny hated Smathers,
didn't he? Yeah, and I didn't like Smathers. But he wouldn't go back against someone who'd been his friend, and he was hurt by him.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't, you know, and he didn't see him as much and everything personally, but he just wouldn't ever, you know, finally say, okay, you're now we're enemies. Because he was just too kind.
Mm-hmm.
So he just let things go on.
Mm-hmm. Mansfield, he thought, was doing an excellent job in the Senate. And McCormick, all right, Boggs, he ever mentioned?
Well, I know he liked Hale Boggs very mm-hmm. much, yes. And Hale Boggs had been our friends before the White House. We used to see them. You asked me before who we saw. In Mansfield we saw.
Mm-hmm.
He always loved Hale Boggs.
Mm-hmm. But he looked forward to the legislative breakfast.
Yeah.
They were fun. On, unreal this. Shall I send you this list? With anything else that occurs to me?
Well, just give me the little thing that you don't have to type it. Just give me the scribbling.
Well, let me make a copy of it myself. Shakespeare.
You want a piece of paper?
No, sir.
Oh, here I've got a whole pen.
Oh, really? You said about Johnson doing a kind of on tape, a confession of how inadequate he was?
Oh, no. Joe Crack said that someone who'd been at that house got so frightened and was so, rocked by seeing Johnson in his cups at 4 a.m. saying he doubted he had the equipment to be president, that this person went home.
Oh, I see.
And put it on tape.
Oh, I see.
I don't know who that person was.
Right.
Quite a good attitude.
I wonder, you suck. Improbable. McMillan looked very well.
He did, didn't he? And the he didn't have that funny sort of droopy look he used to have.
No, exactly. He looked very nice on him, like very sort of spruce and chipper. And, looked like he'd just come in from the country.
Well, I hope things are looking up for him, because he really...
Well, he intervened in a by-election at Devizes and gave a speech, and the Tories held Devizes, much to everyone's astonishment. And he felt, I think, very cheerful about that. As if, he thought he was incredibly...
You know, in the Cuban crisis, I didn't say it in the tape, but I was so surprised at all these people that did go away, whose husbands were working in it.
Really? Was there a... It seems to me that your reaction, that's a reaction you have to have.
Yeah, and that... Oh, then maybe a lot of them were friends and things later. You know, just not in government or... But, you know, the one thought there was, if anything was going to happen, they wanted to get out with their weapons. The mother and the children. My God. I don't think that shows you love your husband very much.
The Seventh Conversation, Wednesday, June 3rd, 1964.
We ended up last time talking about the Cuban crisis, and the next event of great interest was the problem of the British over Schuylkill. Remember, in December, the president went to Bermuda, and then afterwards, did McMillan come back to Florida? I think for a day.
I don't think so. Once they met at Key West, that was the very beginning.
That was the very beginning.
No, I don't think McMillan did.
Well, David Ormsby Gore came back, and Randolph Churchill, but not McMillan.
Is this the Skyboat time?
Because
that was at Nassau.
The meeting was at Nassau.
Yeah.
After Nassau.
Yeah.
I think David and Randolph came and spent a day, didn't they, at Palm Beach?
That's right. And is that what you want me to tell
about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. First they met in Nassau, because Jack told David to tell McMillan he wouldn't meet in Bermuda again, because there was no, in the Governor General's house, there was no hot water for the bath. So they met at Nassau. Then, I don't think Jack saw Randolph Churchill, and not till later, but I remember the next day sitting out when Godfrey McHugh came running in with a dispatch that whatever company it is had shot Skybolt, and saying, "Look, what wonderful news, Mr. President." And I said, told you before about him saying, "God damn it, Godfrey." It was just too awful to be true. And then he got on the phone and tracked everyone down, and Gilpatrick said he didn't know, and McNamara was away. I don't know if you've read Dick Neustadt's thing on Skybolt, have you? Well, Jack gave me that about November 20th, and said, "This is the." Usually, he never brought anything home from his, not much home to show me from his office. And he said, "This is the most fascinating reading." And he said, "Read it." And so I took it to Texas with me. It's been in my briefcase ever since. I've never read it. But anyway, it explains all the little hitches back and forth.
Well, you think the president was deeply concerned?
Oh, he was just crushed, because Nassau had gone so beautifully, and McMillan was really in trouble at home, I guess, and whatever they'd worked out was Polaris, you know, hadn't been quite what he wanted, but together they'd, you know, both done the best they could to get something that would be all right for them. And I remember David's face, he just looked like he'd been kicked in the stomach. And Jack saying, "Oh, you know, what are we going to do?" And he felt as if he betrayed the Prime Minister. So David went in another room, carrying his little red dispatch box, and talked on the phone and to McMillan, and they made up what their announcement or something would be, but they were just both sick about it. And, you know, especially, I think Jack always felt that contributed so to McMillan's troubles. And it, as he said, it's always some third person down the line somewhere whose fault it is. It turns out in that thing, which he just explained to me briefly, it's Thornycroft, who Jack always did think was stupid, doing some little thing and someone not being there when someone called. I don't know.
Do you remember anything about the president's mood before he went to Nassau?
Well, not exactly. What would it have been? Nervous anticipation.
Yes, and concern, because it did weaken McMillan's political position. And I think the actual solution was worked out by the president and Mac Bundy and David on the plane down to Nassau.
And I remember Jack being really mad, either talking to me on the phone from Nassau or telling me before he hated Diefenbaker. And Diefenbaker had made some snotty condition that he had to come down there and have lunch with him one day or something. He was mad about that. But, you know, they had a good time, always he and McMillan. I mean, sort of was rather wry laugh. You know, they always had managed to have their jokes, even though they were tinged with despair a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But that was too bad, that whole thing.
Actually, the problem with the testing of Skybolt, though it was a big thing then, didn't have the effect that everyone feared. And it did for about a week.
Oh.
But I think it was so well handled that it...
Well, maybe here, but it really caused trouble for McMillan at home, didn't it?
Well, to some degree, for a time. But Labor didn't want Skybolt either, so they weren't in a position to exploit it for themselves.
I see. And then I remember Randolph Churchill, when Jack went to Washington, came over. Well, he was so pro-Jack and all of that. That was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he saw Jack that time. Maybe he did.
Yes, he came to Washington thereafter and was very proud of the fact that he'd written the one pro-Nassau piece to appear in the...
That's right.
In the British press. The next big thing was de Gaulle's veto of British entrance into the common market. The president was rather fascinated by de Gaulle, wasn't he? As a historical phenomenon?
Well, not so much, you know... Well, of course, he was always interested in him, but really it was more Churchill. And I think probably because I read or said I did de Gaulle's memoirs, and because he used a sentence from one of them when he announced for the presidency, I've always had a certain image of America that's taken from the opening line of de Gaulle's. I've always had a certain image of France. Just that. But he used to talk to me about de Gaulle so realistically, you know, that man was just consumed really with grudges. And he'd explain of how he'd never forgotten the slights of the last World War, or practically that we didn't come earlier into the First World War. You know, when everybody that he was dealing with then is dead and everything. And he just, he was nice about it. He never got mad the way he did, you know, about the Germans or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But he just seemed to have such distaste for someone who was so spiteful. I remember he asked him in Paris, and he was very interested, who we got along with best, Churchill or Roosevelt. And de Gaulle said, with Churchill, I was always in disagreement, but we always reached an accord. With Roosevelt, I was always in agreement, but we always never had an accord, or some lovely little French wordplay. But, you know, so when de Gaulle did that, it was, I wouldn't be surprised if Jack almost expected it. And I remember one time later, I was having to answer a letter to Malraux or something. When Malraux came over for the Mona Lisa, which was way after that, I think, he came for dinner one night alone afterwards. And Jack said he purposely wasn't going to talk to him about all this, you know, France and England and everything, stuff, the kind of thing that Hervé was always so frantic about. And he talked to him only about Red China. Bundy could tell you that conversation. He said, why are all of you worrying about this and that and you're forced to frap and all that? You know, you should just think of Red China and what's going to happen when they get loose. Mauro was rather impressed. But then later on that spring, I had to answer a letter. Or else it was about coming back from Morocco, and I said I wouldn't land in Paris or something. I just never wanted to go near the French again, but there was no way to get home without doing it. And Jack said, no, you mustn't be like that. Don't you see, you're the one avenue that's open. And they think I'm a so-and-so, but they think you're nice because you like France, and you must always leave an avenue open, and you mustn't, again, that thing of conciliation always. You know, he said, what's the point of you getting mad at them too and writing Malraux an insulting letter? But he was just so unchristian of de Gaulle, and Jack gave so much. And that spiteful man gave so little.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he sort of saw that in the long run, de Gaulle would do all this work for La Gloire and everything. And he'd really be remembered as, the man who with Castro and Red China didn't sign the Test Ban Treaty.
Mm-hmm.
Like he used to say about Nehru sometimes, isn't it sad? This man did so much for independence and everything, but he stayed around too long, and now it's all going bit by bit, and he's botching up things. And, you know, Nehru's image really did change a lot in his last years, because Nehru got to be an awfully sanctimonious, I mean, the difference between Hungary and Goa and all of that. And, oh, what was the thing Jack had about that? Very good expression. Something about, it's like the town preacher being caught in the whorehouse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so he had, you asked me about him in Nehru the other day. He had that sort of feeling about him.
Mm-hmm.
And also, what I forgot to tell you about Nehru, it was so funny, Nehru wanting to come on this very private visit, but because there weren't any crowds purposely arranged, out of desperation, the man went to Disneyland, which seemed so unlike Nehru.
Yeah.
Would there be a lot of children who'd yell, Cha-Cha Nehru Zindabad? I mean, this funny thing of ego. So he saw that that was de Gaulle's horrible failure, and I don't think he did think much of him.
Were there any Frenchmen whom he liked and trusted, particularly?
Only when I know it's the Gonzac.
Mm-hmm. Not Hervé.
No, Hervé Mew. I mean, Hervé's whole sort of way of life and his desperation about David Gore. I mean, he always tried to be so nice to Hervé, and sometimes he'd say we should ask him to dinner because he's about to explode again. But no, you know, basically he didn't like the French, and I loathe the French. There's not one French person I can think of except maybe two very simple people.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Boudin, who's so un-French. You know, they're really not very nice. They're all for themselves.
How did the President Malraux, how did that work?
Well, Malraux would talk brilliantly, and so would Jack, and Bundy would always be there, so, you know, it was a wonderful exchange.
Mm-hmm.
But Malraux sort of off in a marvelous fog of cloud. It was very interesting. And they never, you know, really got into policy or all that. I think he was interested in Malraux.
Mm-hmm.
But he saw that de Gaulle treated him like Muggsy O'Leary, mm-hmm. not as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, no one, that was the thing, no one spoke for de Gaulle. There was no point giving really Malraux any messages. And you could give them to him, but...
So he wasn't astonished by de Gaulle then. He rather expected that de Gaulle would have a headstrong...
Well, maybe he was a little astonished in the beginning because he really tried hard and went over backwards, but... Well, maybe he was a little astonished, but then he got to see that it was his classic pattern and it just wasn't going to get any better. And he was really irritated. I told you before, I would do a goal set after Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's another time that I think there was sincere irritation.
Mm-hmm.
That proved we'd never defend Europe. I mean, just a damn troublemaker that man was.
Yeah, he wanted de Gaulle to come to the United States, and I think de Gaulle had agreed to come in March.
Yes, it was going to be January even, and it was going to be at Hyannis. And Hervé always said, if only they could talk and meet the way Macmillan and Jack met anywhere, you know, and halfway, this and that, but do it a lot. And this time I think Hervé was right. He said, even if nothing's accomplished, but for de Gaulle, you know, that was, he would want it to be some momentous meeting or something. But, I think that meeting would have had terrific results in a way, or some results.
Mm-hmm.
And for finally de Gaulle to agree and all that.
The president had some expectations that a meeting with de Gaulle might ease things.
Yes. And, you know, de Gaulle respected Jack in the whole way his opinion changed of him in Paris. I mean, I don't know what his opinion was, but obviously everyone thought, who is this young president?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the way he'd speak to me of him during the endless dinners we sat next to each other. You could just see that he was, what he told me about him after his funeral upstairs. You know, and then what...
What did he say?
Well, I mean that he just was one of these, you know... So impressive. And then Sir Gonzac sent me a letter, which I can show you, that Burin de Rosier, who I think is de Gaulle's chief of cabinet, told Sir Gonzac what de Gaulle really thought of Kennedy. And, you know, he thought, I mean, as long as Kennedy was alive, he was the leader of the West.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe de Gaulle didn't like it sometimes, but he really looked up to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, apparently, Bobby told me this later. Someone at Bolin or someone had said, tried to say that Johnson would be all right. He was the one Kennedy chosen as vice president. You know, reassure him in the first days. And about a month or so later, he said, I think you, Kennedy may have made a mistake, or you all may have made a mistake about that man. In other words, his opinion of Johnson fell very low. So he wouldn't have dared to. He never would have recognized Red China. I'm sure if Jack had been alive, or so many little things like that, because he respected him.
Presidents have any particular... do you ever talk about Europe in the sense of European unity and unification? Jean Monnet, for example, did he mention him much?
Well, he always, in the very beginning, thought of Jean Monnet, one of the first for the Medal of Freedom. And, you know, so he thought he was the most wonderful man and that all that he'd worked and believed in and everything. So I think he did think that was a marvelous idea.
Mm-hmm.
But he never sort of, you know, he never really sat and talked to me an hour about European unity. But I know he thought he was for it, wasn't
mm-hmm.
he?
Yes, and I think that's quite characteristic. He was very much for it, but he was much less interested than a lot of the people in the State Department about the questions of structure and all this kind of thing. And I think quite rightly so, because he knew that this, if it came, it would come in its own way, and that you could get obsessed with these sort of tactical questions about it.
Yeah, he never seemed to be pressing it or anything, but...
And he saw it as a historic inevitability.
Oh, and then he told me something very interesting. Oh, if he'd only written these things down, because I've forgotten them. But what made de Gaulle veto the common market and what Macmillan had told him and how Macmillan had been out at Rambouillet about 2 weeks before.
That's right.
And everything seemed to be fine. And then there was some little thing here or there, some typically French thing of like Hervé always being mad when he's not given precedence. Well, something that some country or person did that irritated him. And, bang, and we turned around and did the other.
I think he may have felt, was it possibly this, that...
Or maybe Nassau made him change
it? No, that he...
That Macmillan told him at Nassau about Rambouillet.
Yes, but the Macmillan at Rambouillet had not said anything to de Gaulle about the Nassau agreement, and de Gaulle believed, did not understand that the Nassau agreement was drawn up, the Nassau plan was drawn up on the plane down to Nassau, and supposed that Macmillan had already known about it then, was holding out on him.
Might
that have been the...
That's it.
The thing?
I guess so, yeah.
Because I heard somewhat that sort of thing from the French here, that Macmillan came to Rambouillet and held out on de Gaulle, and therefore de Gaulle regarded that as a personal betrayal.
And that's why he said he did the common market, though at Rambouillet it had all looked wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah.
Why he did the common market so brutally. I think that in any case he might have done it, but not in that kind of contemptuous way that he did it. On other European leaders, Fanfani came here a couple of times. In fact, when I saw Fanfani, he reminded me that he first met the president of the Chicago Convention in 1956.
Well, he liked Fanfani.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was sort of the opening to the left and everything, I suppose. They got on well, and I can't think of any, but I mean, he wasn't just, you know, inspired by young belief by him. I can't think of any other leaders. I don't know, Tito had a violent temper too when he saw him, so that
was
kind of
difficult.
Well, how
was the Tito thing?
I wasn't there, and I guess the poor man had a fever of 102 and couldn't eat anything,
mm-hmm.
So it was mostly, you know, polite and all of that, but... nothing much. I don't know really much about that.
Mm-hmm. How did the Indian trip, which you and Lee took, happen to come up?
Well, Nehru brought it up when he was here at dinner or something, and then Ken Galbraith jumped on the idea. Then it was delayed so many times. You know, I was still so terribly tired after John, and I didn't really want to go on that trip. But yet I sort of wanted to go to India.
Mm-hmm.
So once it was delayed, you just weren't up to it, or something was happening, I forget what. Could it have had something to do with Cuba? I don't know. It was put off. Anyway, just to show you one thing, how sweet Jack was, the schedule came back for 2 weeks all over India. My God, it would have killed him campaigning. And you wrote back and forth and you tried to change it, and Ken would keep saying that the children at Mysore were weaving garlands and this and that. So finally we cut it with a map to very small, you know, just mostly Rajasthan and around India. And it was, we were in Florida, either Washington's birthday or Easter or something, Christmas, I don't know, spring, I forget when we went. And Jack got through to Ken Galbraith, and Ken was really protesting on the phone, and he spent the whole last day of his little holiday there shouting to Ken on a bad connection. You know, saying it's too much for her, and Ken, I don't care, everyone complains, it's just what they say in campaigns when you tell them you can't, I'm not going to let her, she's tired. And he really fought to have that chopped off. Well, and so he did that. You know, I guess he... It was wonderful to go to India, and he didn't really care if I went or not, but I guess he thought it would be nice.
Well, I think he was very pleased with it and very proud of the success, and I think he thought that, well, as you mentioned yourself, in connection with France, that quite apart from it's nice for you to get a holiday and get out of Washington, I think it helped the country, and it helped him in important respects.
Well, it was so funny, the difference between India and Pakistan, because India was really just getting to know Nehru, who did like Lee and me, and never mentioned Pakistan or anything. And then there was Ken Galbraith and B.K. Nehru and Madame Pandit and her sister. It was much more like a family group.
Mm-hmm.
The meals were pleasant, And when we got to Pakistan, of course, I basically liked the Paks more than the Indians. They're sort of more manly, and I have never stopped talking politics or how he hated Nehru or couldn't stand him. And I did get a message from the State Department, from Ken, to make sure that it looked like McConaughey was an old friend of Jack's. So the first thing I did when McConaughey and Ayub and I, McConaughey got there the day I did, the day before as the ambassador. So I tried to sort of say, you know, set it up that they'd known each other when and everything. And McConaughey said, oh, no, that's right in front of Ayub. That's not true at all, Mrs. Kennedy. The first time I ever met the president was 2 weeks ago when I gave and the only time I ever wrote Jack a letter, which I wrote coming down from the Khyber Pass and gave him when I got home, was what a hopeless ambassador McConaughey was for Pakistan and all the reasons and all the things I thought the ambassador there should be, which was a gentleman, a soldier, and a friend of the president's. And I suggested some other people, Bill Blair and Bill Battle. And Jack was so impressed by that letter, he showed it to Dean Rusk, whose big choice McConaughey had been, and said, this is the kind of letter I should be getting from the inspectors of embassies. You know, he'd never been for McConaughey, who was a sweet man, but just such a... when we went to Rawalpindi, the Parry Match reporter was yelling as we got off the plane, Bonjour, Jacqueline. And that night, McConaughey said to Ayub Khan, Mr. President, I was so interested to hear all that French at the airport today. I never realized there was so much French influence in Pakistan. Well, Ayub just looked at him and said, I think if you will find out that the influence here has been mainly British. But you know, Dean Rusk. Anyway, that was my trip. And our trip was so exhausting that all through Pakistan, Lee and I were having nosebleeds every day and night. So we were really tired when we got home.
He hasn't talked much about Africa. Congo.
Yes. Once he said about Ed Gullion and Bill Atwood, he said, and Bill Atwood had gotten sick there and everything, yeah. And, you know, you were so sorry for him. He said, those are so much more the important places to be now as a diplomat. And he said, London and Paris and everything don't matter anymore. There's the telephone and, you know, it's really done that way. But he says it's those far out places in Africa that are, you know, the exciting places for a diplomat to be, when you can do the most. And he always, Ed Gullion, you know, he'd always had a special feeling for it because when he was doing his Indochina speech, which was the year before we were married, because I'd had to type it all up from that summer, translate all these French books and everything. Ed Gullion was the only person in the State Department who would sort of talk to Jack and who would really say how awful Indochina was and the way it was going. Mm-hmm. And I guess he got fired because of that. He
got shifted out of that area. Other things.
He put in some pathetic little post. Mm-hmm. We always used to see him all the time. And then I think Jack naming him to the Congo just showed what he thought of him. Mm-hmm. But he thought he was exceptional.
1963, one of the big things in the president's mind was, of course, Vietnam and Diem and Madame Nu and all that.
Yes, you know, obviously it was trouble for so long, and you didn't ask Jack about it when he came home and everything, but I know I forget how long Lodge was out there before things really got bad. About how many months?
He was out of, I guess, about 3 months before the Diem was run out.
Well, I know that he started acting rather strangely, and he sort of wouldn't answer the cables, or you couldn't get through, or... Anyway, as if he was kind of taking it into his own hands or something. And what I can remember is when the coup came, Jack was just sick. I know he'd done something to try and Lodge had started something and they'd stopped. All of this you can learn from other people, because a lot of it I learned later. But he'd done something to stop it, something couldn't. But anyway, when Diem was murdered, Jack was... he just had that awful look that he had at the time of the Bay of Pigs. I mean, he was just so... just wounded, and he was shaking his head, and was home in our, you know, in our room at the White House. And he was saying, oh, you know, no, why? And he said, GM fought communism for 20 years and everything, and it shouldn't have ended like this. He was just sick about it. Madam knew, tearing all around, saying things about him. I suppose she was more of an irritant. But once I asked him, why are these women like her and Claire Luce, who both obviously are attractive to men, why are they? Why do they have this queer thing for power? She was everything that Jack found unattractive, that I found unattractive in a woman. And he said, it's strange, he said, but it's because they resent getting their power through men. And so they become really just hating men, whatever you call that. You know, this thing. She was rather like Claire Luce. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if they were lesbian.
Claire Luce wrote very favorable pieces about it.
Yeah.
You remember?
But Claire Luce had come to lunch with Jack once in the White House when Tish was still there. And I remember, she so badly wanted to come to see him as a man would. She didn't want to... You know, she wanted to see him in his office or something anyway. A sort of a male lunch was arranged. And Tish told me she was so nervous before she'd had about 3 martinis. And I was so mad at her that I stood, I managed to be just outside our dining room, standing there pretending to shuffle through my desk. And I just really cut her dead so that when Jack introduced us and I just stood with my hands at my side and finally walked over, he said to me later, you know, he said, if you're going to cut someone dead, dear. You know, he was sort of touched at my loyalty. Because it could only make Mrs. Luce hurt me more, but he really wasn't very pleased at my doing that. He said, you know, do it naturally, but don't just set it up and lay the trap for them. And apparently all through that lunch, Mrs. Luce, who I guess was a bit loaded, just went on and lit into him and told him all these things. And finally, he was always... You know, so courteous to women, he said, well, I'm sorry, Mrs. Luce, but unfortunately, you're not in a position to do anything about these things, and I am, and that's how it ended. And the sad thing about it, that is, they'd been friends, and she'd been a friend of Mr. Kennedy's,
mm-hmm.
and he'd helped her so, you know, the time when Morse and all that, when she didn't go to Brazil, mm-hmm. well, both Harry Luce and Mr. Kennedy told her she shouldn't go. And Jack called her up especially and said, you know, now they're wrong. You know, you'll be much happier there. You need to be doing something. And he said, all this will blow over. And, you know, I really advise you to take it. And my father's older and he sees things this way. Well, she didn't take it. And I think Jack was completely right.
Mm-hmm.
What did she do? Then she went back to Arizona and made little mosaic tables and got bitterer and bitterer and more venomous.
And swam underwater?
Yeah. And he tried to help her.
Mm-hmm.
And so for her to turn on him like that, well, again, this resentment of man.
And Harry Luce remained friendly.
Yeah, I think, I know Jack saw him a couple of times and, you know, it was all right. I mean, he might blow up at him for certain things,
mm-hmm.
but they would, you know, never got bitter that way.
Mm-hmm. How did Luce happen to write the introduction to Why England Slept?
Oh, that was Mr. Kennedy, because Jack had gotten Arthur Croft to do it. And then Mr. Kennedy thought that it might look as if Arthur Croft had written a book or something, because he'd been no friend of the family,
mm-hmm.
and that it would be better if Henry Luce did it. So it was sort of changed midstream, and that's one thing Arthur Croft never forgave Jack for. I mean, the last time we saw him, he even brought it up.
Oh, really?
But forgave Mr. Kennedy for it. It was a real slight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that's where this queer enmity that Croft had for him, who after all he'd known as a young boy and known me, and he'd sort of been his mentor, not exactly mentor, but, you know, seen him and everything, this sort of bitterness started. And that's when. But it was Mr. Kennedy changing it.
I can remember in the first winter, the dinner at the White House, with when the Crocs were there. So they were still a slight relationship then. But then Crock became absolutely hopeless.
You try over and over. You see, he'd been a friend of me growing up, gotten me my job in the Times Herald, always a, you know, a friend of my grandfather's. We used to write poems to each other for both of us. And you try over and over to do something about the relationship. And each time you just get slapped in the face with a wet fish. And finally you gave up. He was too bitter and he couldn't bear to see someone young coming on. And we went out of our way to be nice and we even went to their house for dinner as president.
You did? When was this? In the beginning? Or?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sometime that year. I think it was in the spring.
Mm-hmm. On this, on Vietnam, it was rather interesting that the president should send Cabot Lodge, whom he had defeated in the Senate in 1952 and who ran on the opposite ticket in 1960. Had he and Lodge maintained particular personal relations in this period?
No, the only time I can remember we asked Lodge to the dinner for Aboud of the Sudan. And Lodge was really nice that evening. I mean, I think Jack had always thought of him as rather arrogant and everything. Well, he seemed so touched to be there and so sort of, well, polite. And I remember Jack walked into the door. Once he was president, he did these extraordinary sort of thoughtful things to go out of his way. Lodge was just very nice then. And when we went upstairs, I said, you know, he just seemed so nice that evening. And Jack said, yeah, I think he probably did it